So I wanted to do some sutta classes, and because talking about suttas is something that I really love to do. And I wanted to choose for this series of four like seminars or four short workshops. I want to choose four suttas that would be in some way representative of the teachings in the Pali Canon, but which would also be quite different. We didn't want to choose the same old suspects, right? And many of you have been, if you've been around in Buddhism before, you probably, you know, there's certain sermons which of the Buddha, which are taught many, many times. The Buddha's first teaching in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta or the Satipatthana Sutta on the foundations of mindfulness and so on. And these ones are taught very commonly. So I wanted to do something which is not taught so often. But before we proceed, I'd just like to ask a question. How many people here have like no idea what a sutta is? Excellent. Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Okay. How many people have only a very little idea what a sutta is and have only read a few suttas and things, don't have much background? Okay. Good. Excellent. Thank you. How many people are like real experts in the suttas and are just going to sit there and pick me apart on every little detail? Anna, I'm relying on you, okay? Okay, very good. So one of the things that I think in the Buddhist tradition is that because I've always loved the sutta so much, and when we're talking about suttas, we're talking about the teachings of the Buddha. And when it comes to, so for the benefit of those who are just very new to it, I'll just give a little bit of background before we start looking at this particular sutta. So the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago, right? It's a long time, right? That was before Facebook. Yes, it's true. There was a time before Facebook. Right? So, and the Buddha was born, lived, and taught in the Ganges Plain in Upper India. Okay? And during that time, he taught for 45 years. And during that time, he established a community, which we call it the fourfold Sangha, fourfold community of monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. And that was established right across a large area of northern India before the Buddha had died. That community then memorized and passed down the teachings of the Buddha. And these teachings were passed down in various forms. And some of those collections, they were collected into various like canons or what we call a pitaka, is a basket of scriptures, and some of those scriptures have survived to the present. The main one that we have in the present is what we call the Pali Canon, and the Pali Canon recorded in the Pali language, originally brought from India to Sri Lanka and then subsequently taken from Sri Lanka to throughout Southeast Asia. And if you look here, these lines in the grey here, this is in Pali. And Pali is a language of ancient India from around the time of the Buddha or a bit later. Scholars are still kind of discussing whether the Buddha himself literally spoke Pali. Actually, most scholars these days would say that the Buddha spoke a dialect, and we don't really know whether he spoke exactly Pali. But recently there's been an argument that he did in fact speak precisely Pali, the actual Pali language, although that's not really accepted by many scholars. But the main point is that these are teachings from the earliest time of Buddhism that have been transmitted through the Buddhist traditions to us. And the Pali Canon has been transmitted through the Theravada tradition in Southeast Asia, and as such is a complete and very well-preserved set of scriptures which has been maintained through a living tradition. In addition to the Pali Canon, we also have a number of other what we call these early Buddhist texts, or EBTs for short. Okay, so the early Buddhist texts. And so the early Buddhist texts are texts which are the Pali Canon and things that are similar to the Pali Canon, which are preserved in four main languages, Pali, Chinese, Sanskrit, and Tibetan. And the website that I run, Sutta Central, which you can see in front of you, collects all of those scriptures in all of those languages and shows all the relationships between them. All right, so we currently, and the thing is that these are very, very interconnected collections of teachings, so much so that we have many tens of thousands of what we call parallels, which are links between these different scriptures. Okay. So that's a little bit of background as to the Buddhist scriptures and what we call the suttas. Okay. Now, I just want to say as a caveat or a caution here that you will find many, many things which people say the Buddha said that he didn't really say. I mean, come on, right? People say things on television yesterday, and people say all kind of, they said things that they didn't say and all of that kind of thing, right? So, of course, from 2,500 years ago. And to help you on that path is a wonderful website, fakebuddhaquotes.com, all right? So if you're in doubt about that, check out fakebuddhaquotes.com. And he has a nice, it actually is a really well done website because he looks at all these things that people attribute to the Buddha, and then he looks at where they actually came from and then how they got brought into the Buddhist tradition and so on. So if you're ever in doubt if something was really spoken by the Buddha, then you can check out fakebuddhaquotes.com, or you can come to Sutta Central. We have a forum and you can ask a question on the forum, or any questions you have about the suttas. I usually check out our forum every day. So if you have a question for me, you can come and tag me on the forum and I will try my best to answer you. All right. So for this series of four talks, I wanted to choose one discourse from each of the four main Nikayas. So I mentioned before that we have the collections will be passed down in these big baskets, and the main group of suttas that the Buddha's teachings is called the four Nikayas. And for the last 3 years, I spent most of the time translating these four Nikayas. And so there's a lot of material there. It's about 1,000,000 words. Okay, so I spent 2.5 years translating 1,000,000 words of Pali. And I still forget where things are, like all the time. Anyway, so I wanted to pick a representative sutta from one from each of those four Nikayas. And I wanted to pick something that's going to be important and interesting, but also quite unusual that you might not have heard of. And so the first one we're going to kick off with is the Great Dreams. So this refers to where the Buddha talks about five great dreams that he had on the eve of his, or just before his enlightenment. And to begin with, I'll just read out the sutta. Okay? So let's have a bit of a sutta reading for the next few minutes. Mendicants, I should mention this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, number 5.196. Mendicants, before his awakening, five great dreams appeared to the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha, when he was still not awake, but intent on awakening. What five? This great earth was his bed. Himalaya, king of mountains, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea. His right hand was laid down in the western sea. And both his feet were laid down in the southern sea. This is the first great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, a kind of grass called the crosser grew up from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. This is the second great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, white caterpillars with black heads crawled up from his feet and covered his knees. This is the third great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, four birds of different colors came from the four directions. They fell at his feet, turning pure white. This is the fourth great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, he climbed up a huge mountain of filth but remained unspoiled. Actually, I should... well, I was just checking this before the class. I realized I made a mistake in the translation here. Sorry about that, everybody. It should read, next, he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth. I don't know if it changes the meaning much, but that's actually what it says. This is the fifth great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Before his awakening, the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha, was still not awake but intent on awakening. This great earth was his bed. Himalaya, king of mountains, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea. His right hand was laid down in the western sea. And both his feet were laid down in the southern sea. This was fulfilled when the Buddha awakened to the perfect awakening. This was the first great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. A kind of grass called the crosser grew up from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. This was fulfilled when, after the Buddha had awakened to the Noble Eightfold Path, it was well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. This was the second great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. White caterpillars with black heads crawled up from his feet and covered his knees. This was fulfilled when many white-clothed lay people went for refuge to him for life. This was the third great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. Four birds of different colors came from the four directions. They fell at his feet, turning pure white. This was fulfilled when members of the four castes, aristocrats, Brahmins, merchants, and workers, went forth from the lay life to homelessness in the teaching and training proclaimed by the Realized One and realized supreme freedom. This was the fourth great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. He climbed up a huge mountain of filth, he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth, but while remaining unsoiled. This was fulfilled when the Realized One received robes, alms food, lodgings and medicines and supplies for the sick, and he used them untied, uninfatuated, unattached, seeing the drawbacks and understanding the escape. This was the fifth great dream that appeared to him while he was still not awakened. Before his awakening, these five great dreams appeared to the Realized One, the Perfected One, the fully awakened Buddha, when he was still not awake, but intent on awakening. Okay, so this is the discourse. As you can see, it's a fairly short and straightforward one. The Buddha presents the five dreams and then gives a brief explanation for each one of those dreams. And this particular sutta, when you're on Sutta Central, one of the things that you want to do if you want to look at some more detail a particular sutta, you can click up here and get this card and it will tell you, there's some parallel for this sutta. And, my internet's not working. Excuse me. Is it going to work? I'm not sure if my Buddhist library internet is still going to connect. There we go. There we go. So there's a parallel for this in a Sanskrit text called the Sanskrit Loputaravada Mahavastu. And we'll have a look at that in just a minute. But just briefly, the Mahavastu is a biography of the Buddha, telling the life story of the Buddha, collected by another school of Buddhism called the Mahasangika or the Loputaravada school of Buddhism. That particular collection is distinguished by the fact that it is a rather higgledy-piggledy mess of all different kinds of stuff. And it's almost as if they just kind of collected all the things that they could about the life of the Buddha and just kind of bunged it all in there in kind of vaguely chronological order, repeating stories all the time and getting bits and pieces from different sources and stuff, which means from a reading point of view, it's a nightmare, but from a scholarly point of view, it's fantastic, right? Yeah, because they tended to just put the original text were just plonked in there, right? And so it actually preserves the text in a quite original form. And Mahavastu has a lot of very interesting things in there. For example, many of you, if you come from a Theravadan background, will be familiar with the Ratna Sutta. It's one of the most famous suttas in Buddhism. But the Mahavastu has also a version of the Ratna Sutta, which is almost identical with the Pali, but it has an extra verse in it. Very interesting. An extra verse in the Ratna Sutta. And from linguistic and analysis, it seems like it's actually an authentic verse which might have been lost from the Pali canon. So there you go, mysterious extra verse in the Ratna Sutta. So anyway, the point being that Mahavastu has a lot of interesting things, and it so happens that it preserves a version of this particular sutta, which we will look at in a minute. Okay. So I'll start out by just giving a few reflections and a bit of background on this particular sutta before going ahead with trying looking at it in a bit more detail. So the first thing to understand is that this is something which occurred to the Buddha on the eve of his awakening. And so as we know, Buddha is not a personal name, but is the title, right? So he was not, his name wasn't Buddha. He didn't sign form. What's your name? Buddha, right? No, his name was Siddhartha Gautama, and the title was the Buddha. So he's also, many other titles are given to him. You can see here he refers to himself as the realized one, the Tathagata. But before he was enlightened, he was known as the Bodhisatta. Right? And you can see this term here, Bodhisatta. In Sanskrit, they say Bodhisattva, which you will know is a very common phrase today. And everyone knows what the Bodhisattva is. Problem is that in the suttas, in the early suttas, the word bodhisattva has a quite different meaning than it does today. If you think of what a bodhisattva means, someone tell me, what does bodhisattva mean? Buddha to be born, okay? Buddha to be good. Anything else? Bodhi awaken, satta being, good, thank you. Right, exactly. Thank you. Yes. So there we go. Bodhi is Sattva, enlightenment. So it's an enlightenment being who is a Buddha to be in future lives who will put up their own enlightenment so they can get enlightened in the future as a Bodhisattva. It's completely different from what Bodhisattva means in the Pali Canon. All right. And it's really important it's an important point to bear in mind, because when I was translating, I couldn't count the times when people tell me, oh, just keep that word in Pali so that people, the meaning will be clear and you can't mistake the meaning, right? But that's not how language works, like, at all. Words change their meaning all the time. And if you keep the same word in Pali for 2,500 years, of course the meaning of the word changes. Of course it changes. Have you ever heard of a little thing called impermanence? Yes? Buddhists are so weird. We're like, oh, everything's impermanent. The whole world's impermanent. The cosmos is impermanent. Oh, yeah, but Buddhism. No. Buddhism, that's not impermanent, right? Of course such meanings of words change. They change all the time. Right? And the word bodhisatta, as you can see here in the suttas, is used to refer to Siddhartha Gautama in the period of practice before he became enlightened. So like the 6 years or so when he was practicing before he became enlightened. It's not used to refer to him in past lives. There's no idea that he deferred his enlightenment in order to realize enlightenment in the future. On the contrary, it refers precisely to the time when he went forth in order to strive and attain enlightenment in this present day. Okay? Now, if we want to sort of look at what that word meant and how the changes in the idea of the Buddha and so on over the years, then we could have a whole session on that. But that's not this session, so I'm not going to discuss it in too much detail. But I just want you to understand that when the word bodhisattva appears here, it doesn't have any particular connotation for saying that, you know, he's somebody who's been practicing for countless past lives or anything like that. None of those ideas are found in the early texts. All it means is that he had left home. And notice how I've translated it here as one intent on awakening. And that's assuming that the correct derivation of it is in fact bodhisattva rather than bodhisattva. So the word bodhisattva means enlightenment being, which is a kind of weird compound, especially when he's obviously not enlightened, as it says in fact right there. Clearly from the context what it means is that he's striving for enlightenment. Yeah? And so the Sanskrit word shakta would be turned into Pali as Satta. And so it seems most likely that the original meaning was one intent on enlightenment, but it was incorrectly Sanskritized to Bodhisattva at a later date. So, any case. So this fits within the life of the Buddha. And again, I'm sure most of you will be familiar with that story. He was brought up in a well-to-do family. He became disillusioned, terrified by the prospect of death, wanted to find a way beyond death, and left home, spent 6 years striving in the wilderness when he tried all kinds of different meditations and ascetic practices and so on before finally coming to that time of his enlightenment. And this, according to the tradition, this occurred just very, very shortly before his enlightenment. Now, One of the characteristics of the Buddhist tradition and of the Buddhist teachings is that the Buddhist teachings are highly rational. All right? And so if you look at this, it's like you find this constantly through the Buddhist teachings, right? The Buddha says, if you're feeling restless, what do? Well, you watch your breath because your breath is calm and then it makes your mind peaceful, right? It's very rational, right? Or even if you're feeling angry, what do? Oh, well, you develop love. Yeah? It makes sense, right? So the Buddha was always very pragmatic and very rational in the way he approached things. And in particular, one of the very radical things that the Buddha did was that he dispensed entirely with superstitions, with rituals, with all the mythology and all of that stuff, which often we think of as religion, right? So he just basically ignored most of that stuff. And it's important to recognize that in the time that the Buddha was living, was the ritual and mythology and all of that stuff totally dominated the religious sphere. So when we read something like, say, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the Noble Eightfold Path doesn't have anything about ritual, right? How incredibly radical that is. Yeah? How incredibly radical. The Buddha just didn't even bother mentioning it, right? I mean, of course, it came up sometimes when questions would come up in discussions, but when he's mainly talking about Dhamma, he just ignores all that stuff, right? And so the teachings are highly rational. However, human beings aren't really all that rational. I mean, we're kind of a bit rational sometimes, right? I think we can be reasonably rational. I mean, there's certainly a dimension to us which is somewhat rational. But there's also a lot more to us, right? And there's a lot that goes on in the unconscious. There's a lot of things like with dreams and symbols and all of these kinds of things which we don't really know or understand very much about. And so this is one of those suttas, which is a fairly rare one, that actually goes in and addresses some of those less rational aspects of the human psyche. Now, in doing so, I'd like to draw a basic distinction to begin with, and that's the distinction between a sign and a symbol. Okay? What do you think I mean by that? What's the difference between a sign and a symbol? Who wants to tell me? I mean, you have to guess what I mean by it, but anyway, tell me what you understand by it. Sign is a description and the symbol is representative. Okay. Anybody else? I'll just hear what you're saying for now. Because I might be using the words completely wrongly, so I just have to figure that out. Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. The sign can be a herald of something. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Okay, so they're both fine, but they've got nothing to do with what I was meaning by that, so maybe I need to choose different words. Anyway, what I mean by that is this. Signs eliminate meaning. Symbols amplify meaning. Right? The purpose of a sign is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the sign and the thing the sign is pointing to. That's the whole point of a sign. We put a sign on the road down here saying Church Street. Why? Because you want to come to this street and not another street, right? So the whole point is to eliminate every other street in the world and just have this one street. Think of the icons on your phone, right? The whole point of having an icon on the phone is that it's simple and unambiguous. I know that if it's this icon, it means that, and it can be predictable. I can click on that, and the same thing's going to happen every time. So signs aim to eliminate meaning, to narrow meaning down to one specific thing, okay? Symbols act to amplify meaning. Symbols are suggestive, right? Yeah. Symbols evoke something. They evoke a response. And they invite us to look at things from multiple different ways. Yeah? So if you're reading poetry or you're listening to a song and there's a symbol in there, yeah, and somebody talks about the riders on the storm, right? What does the riders on the storm mean? Right? It doesn't mean anything necessarily particularly, right? But it evokes some kind of response in that context. And the whole idea from a literary point of view is to evoke that ambiguity and that creative response so that a reader will engage with it and will begin to explore their own personal response to a work. Right? So this is something about the difference between a sign and a symbol. It's not to say that one is any better than the other. It's just to recognize that there are different kinds of things that superficially seem to be the same, but actually are quite different. And what we tend to find in Buddhism, and this sutra is no different, is that that the tendency in Buddhism as a rational religion is to turn things into signs, right? So Buddhism is more comfortable with things as signs because they have a nice, clear meaning. As we find in this sutta, right? We have these dreams, and each dream is given one meaning. That's it. That's the answer, right? So you can now do a test on this sutta, and you can get 5 out of 5 for interpreting the dream of the Buddha, right? But of course, dreams aren't really like that. Right? Dreams are weird. That's like almost the canonical definition of the word weird, right? I had such a weird dream. Did anybody ever say, wow, last night I had such a normal dream? That's the whole point of dreams, yeah, is to be weird. So it's talking about dreams here. And it's giving a set of meanings to that. And on the surface level, we can say, okay, we can look at what those dreams mean on a certain surface level. And we'll look at that in a bit later on. But at the same time, they also evoke something. They have connections. And they move into different realms and call up different kinds of responses in ways that are much more mysterious and much more personal. One of the things that I'll show a little bit later is a little bit how that has happened within the Buddhist tradition itself. Now, these particular dreams are not perhaps the most famous part of the Buddha's biography, but they are remembered in the Buddhist tradition and they are recognized and discussed and so on in a number of different places. And this we'll have a look a bit later at some artwork which has been inspired by these dreams. Again, there's not that much that I've found, but there is some. Okay, so these 5 dreams. And this is, it's as in talking about dreams is a little bit out of place compared to the other things that we find about the Buddha before his enlightenment. I mean, if we think about that story of the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, he what do? You want to escape from suffering, you go and practice with the best known spiritual teachers of your time, right? Makes sense, right? And you practice and you learn what they have to say, and you say, does that answer my questions? No? Okay, well, I'll go to the next one, right? And then finally he recognizes, oh, yes, there's this meditation which I did as a child and that will lead me to enlightenment. And then he practices that meditation. It's actually, it all seems quite sensible. Yeah? And then he has these dreams that just sort of pop up. And they don't seem to contribute anything very much. Like, it doesn't change the story, right? You could leave this sutta out completely and it really wouldn't change anything about Buddhism. But it does give you a different way of looking at things that kind of enriches that picture, or to me it does anyway. All right, so what's the time now? Sorry, 1:35. Okay, so what I'll do is now I've given a bit of an introduction to this sutta. What I'd like to do now maybe is just do some meditation, maybe a 5-minute meditation, and during the session we'll just break for short meditations just to give you a chance to assimilate and refresh, and so that we can not get too much information. Okay. is I'd like to go through the sutta in a looking at it a bit more closely and comparing the Pali version with the hybrid Sanskrit version. And as we do that, after we've done that, then we'll take a break. Now we'll see how far we get with that anyway, and then we'll take a break. Then after the break, I'll give more of a kind of reflective discussion of like looking at the meaning and significance of the dream in different ways, dreams in different ways. And then we might also have some discussion towards the end. Okay, does that sound like a reasonable approach? Okay, now if due to the particular nature of this talk, you are encouraged to fall asleep during the afternoon. And anybody who falls asleep, then I consider you're doing deep research into the topic. So that's great. But you will have to give us a report when you come back. Okay. Very good. And I should mention, like, while I'm doing the talk, we'll have a chance for more discussion later, but while I'm doing the talk, you're most welcome to ask questions. However, I would ask you to ask questions of a specific form, and the question's form is, a question begins with a question word, such as how, who, where, why, or what. It has one short sentence without subsidiary clauses. Life stories, biographies, histories of the universe, etc. And it ends with a question mark. So a question is, why did the Buddha use that particular word in this sutta? What's the relationship between this dream and the Freudian symbolism? And so on. Do you understand the nature of a question? I did this in Indonesia. It was great fun. We had like 50 people. They kept on coming up and asking questions. And we kept on saying to them, like, 10 or 20 times, what is a question? And they just kept on going, rambling on and on and on. And we couldn't get them to stop. It was very fun, anyway. Okay, so just out of compassion for everyone, yeah? So, and if you're not sure how to ask your question clearly, then just write it down. Easy. All right, so now, let me see if this works. Okay, so as I mentioned before, we have the parallel passage in the Mahavastu of the Mahasanghika Lokuttaravada school of Buddhism. One of the things which is actually very useful about this and a bit of Buddhist history is that after the Buddha died, then the Buddhist community preserved his texts. Now, the Buddhist community gradually broke up into different schools of Buddhism. And the earliest split into two different schools of Buddhism was one school, which he called the Stavira school, from which our modern Theravada is derived, and the other school was called the Mahasanghika school. And that was the earliest split, probably 200 years after the Buddha. And so what that means is that when there are scriptures that are preserved in both of those cases, then it's very likely that they come from the earliest period of Buddhism. Unfortunately, we don't have many scriptures from the Mahasanghika group of schools. Most of our scriptures, about 90% of the early Buddhist texts, are from the Stavira group of schools, more than 90% probably. But the Mahavastu is from the Mahasanghika group of schools, so that means that it attests to a scripture which was common in Buddhist tradition before they split into the two branches. Okay, so, and this, I won't go too much more into the Mahavastu. Okay, so what I'll do for here, because I don't have a handy translation of the Sanskrit text, so I'll just read the Sanskrit text. I'll just translate that for you, and you can read the Pali. So on the left is the translation of the Pali and the translation, and on the right is the Sanskrit. And I'll read the translation from the Sanskrit rather than from the Pali. So the Bodhisattva also saw five great dreams. One difference between the Pali and the Sanskrit, the Sanskrit says that he saw the dreams, and in the Pali it says that the dreams had been appeared to him. Parama Sambodhi Prapto, having Having attained to the highest enlightenment, he explained them to his disciples. It says Sravastanang, it's probably a spelling mistake for Sravakanam. And then what are those five? Before the Bodhisattva was enlightened, he dreamt that this great earth, he dreamt that he had this great earth as his large and luxurious bed. Ucchasayana Mahasayana. So you'll be familiar with that phrase from the precepts. High and luxurious bed, doesn't mention that in Pali. I don't know how comfortable it would have been, to be honest. Himalayas is a pretty rocky pillow, but anyway. He had Sumeru Parvat, Sumeru, the great king of mountains, was his pillow. In Pali it says it's the Himalaya. In the Sanskrit it says Sumeru, which was a kind of a mythical mountain, which was the greatest peak of the Himalayas. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea, his right hand was laid down in the western sea, and both of his feet were laid down in the southern ocean. And this was the dream that he saw before he was enlightened. So that one is pretty much the same. So I'll just talk a little bit about the symbolism of this. Now, this is a very kind of powerful dream, right? I mean, it's an incredible scope of it. Right? To think, you know, here he is, like encompassing the whole of the known world. You know, the Himalayas are my pillow. Right? And in the Indic tradition, there's a strong tradition of what's called the Purusha, who is like the cosmic man. And in Jainism, you see this a lot, where the whole cosmos or the whole universe is actually mapped out against the body of a man, of a Purusha. And so there's something about this kind of idea. So what it's kind of attesting to the idea that his enlightenment has some kind of greater cosmic significance, right? It's not just this kind of personal enlightenment that he has for himself, but it's in some way he's going to become the king of the world. But he's lying in this way that's very kind of relaxed, right? It's very at ease. And that image of the Buddha lying down in some ways recalls Mahaparinibbana, right? But also you have a very famous image of the Buddha lying down, or here he's lying on his back. For those of you who are familiar with Indian mythology, then it's inescapable how much this recalls the symbolism of Vishnu lying in the sea of milk, which I'll look at just in a little bit more detail a bit later on. Please. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. Yeah, it was just there in the original text. Sometimes when the files are edited, they have different details in there, and sometimes the meaning of it got lost. It might mean that it was a uncertain reading, or it was reconstructed by the editor. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for those two excellent questions. One of the things which is interesting about this is in the Indian mythology, the Himalayas are considered to be the axis mundi, the center of the earth, right? And there it's like the kind of the pillar that holds up the world. And this is an idea which you find in a lot of different mythologies. In Nordic mythology, you have Yggdrasil, the tree which is the center of the world, or in Greek mythology, Mount Olympus. And so the Buddha is, in the sense, kind of being born from the axis mundi, being born from the center of the world. His feet are the furthest out, and his head is still there on his pillow. So it has this kind of birth symbolism in some way. The fact that he's covering the whole land also, of course, is significant, and I think it's also significant that his feet and hands were laid down in the sea. And previous translators have translated this as having his hands and feet laid down on the sea, which has always struck me as being a little bit awkward, right? How do you lay your hand on the sea? But actually, the meaning of the word ohita more lends itself to being meaning in the sea, I think. Pali has lots of words in it, and it's not always clear what all of them mean. But I think it means in the sea, and I think that makes a significant difference to the symbolism, because in Jungian symbolism, the ocean is the unconscious. And so by resting his hands and his feet in the sea, it's showing that he is literally in touch with the unconscious. Yeah? And so this idea of completion, like he goes from the Himalayas, the highest reaches of the spiritual attainments, all the way to the lowest reaches of the unconscious. Yeah? And so he's encompassing that whole realm of consciousness. And you know, just that idea that he's completely relaxed with it all. Right? And all of these things that are happening, right? All the things that are happening within that. You know, people being born and dying and having wars and fighting and making up and making love and cooking food and driving in chariots and all of those things that people do. And then he's just at peace with everything. You know? It's like... often the symbolism of Buddhism uses symbols of like leaving things behind or things, symbols of being detached with things, right? So you have like the symbol of the lotus leaf with the drop of water which doesn't smear the lotus leaf. We have symbols which are similar to that here. And that's one aspect of the Buddha's enlightenment. But here you have like a different kind of idea. It's like immanent idea. Like he's actually in the world and encompassing all of those things without being touched by it or without being disturbed by it at all. Anders. Just for the microphone, but does the Pali Canon have the idea of the Dhammakaya as in Mahayana Buddhism? No, it doesn't. You could read it in a way like that, yeah. But this is a symbol. I'm treating it here as a symbol. So I'm treating it as something which is like suggestive or evocative, which is different from a doctrine. Yeah? When you make things into doctrines, you start arguing about them, you know? Right. It is, yeah. And there's something suggestive about that, yeah. Okay. So here I'm trying to focus mostly on the text itself. It's the first great dream. Second great dream, mendicants before the realized one's awakening. He saw, he had another great dream, a kind of grass called milky. Okay, so in the Sanskrit, the kind of grass is called milky, kshiraka, and in the Pali is dhirya. I'll come back to that in a minute. The kind of grass called milky arose from his navel and grew up and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. This was the second great dream which the realized one had before his awakening. So again, you can see it's almost exactly the same, just that one difference, which is a kind of curious little difference. The word dhirya, as a name of a kind of grass here, is unknown elsewhere in Pali, and I don't really know quite what it means. I think it's related from the root tarati, to cross over, and having that idea of like it's from the navel up to the sky, and so it's bridging heaven and earth, right? But it's a bit uncertain. And I mentioned before about the image of Vishnu, which I think I have a version of here. There's also Vishnu looking very relaxed there. Where are we now? No, I've got too many images here. Ah, where did I put that one? Oh, that's bad. I thought I had all this organized. Oh, dear. Image of Vishnu. Where are we? Oh, here we go. So here we have Vishnu, again, very relaxed and very chill, lying in the sea of milk, and with a lotus growing out of his navel up to the sky. Seems a bit similar, doesn't it? And this is where Brahma is born. So according to this mythology, Brahma is born out of that navel. But when you're thinking about mythology and so on, don't pay too much attention to the details, right? The details are telling you a particular story in that particular context, right? But just you kind of look at the ideas, right? The idea is reclining in the ocean. And, of course, a connection with the Naga in this one, that he's being in a Naga bed, right? And it's, while the Naga doesn't figure in this particular dream, but in many other images, of course, we find the Buddha being protected by a Naga in very much the same way. So, this, don't overinterpret the mythology and the symbolism, right? This isn't doctrine. Right? This doesn't mean the Vishnu and the Buddha are the same or anything like that. Okay, what it means is it's evoking a similar set of ideas that people are drawing upon, similar kinds of images and associations and connotations to try to communicate something about their religious experience and about their spiritual understanding. Another way of thinking about that is that people often overreach when it comes to symbols, and they say if the symbol is the same, it must be the same thing. But it's better to think about symbols as a language. Right? Just because you're using the same words doesn't mean you're saying the same thing. Yeah? It means you're sharing a common vocabulary, but the specifics of it can be quite different. But I think it's certainly undeniable that there's this relation between these dreams of the Bodhisattva and the images of Vishnu. What also is undeniable is that the dreams of the Bodhisattva, so far as I'm aware, are recorded many centuries before any of this Vishnu iconography ever appeared. So it might be tempting to think that the Buddhist version drew upon the Hindu iconography, but historically it was certainly much earlier. I don't even know. Sorry? That the Hindu book drew on the Buddhist? Absolutely. Or they could have drawn on the pre-existing roots or... Just that we shouldn't rush to conclusions about who's drawing on what. That's a detailed study. But anyway, the main thing is that there's a connection. I'll come back to that a bit later on. Yeah.
The English word?
Yes. Sorry, I thought you were saying the English word tree. No, the sense word. Yes. Exactly, yeah? And so it's something that's crossing over. Must have something like that, some kind of connotation like that. All right. So, and the fact that in Pali it's crossa and in Sanskrit it's milky is also an interesting variation. I'm not sure that you can get from one to the other, so I'm not sure how that kind of change happened. But, of course, Vishnu was said to be lying in a bed of milk. There's something also about, like, a fertility motive going on here. I mean, obviously, it's coming out of his navel. It looks very much like an umbilical cord, right? Lying in the ocean and so on, and this is very much like kind of rebirth imagery. Again, a kind of very powerful set of images drawn from the unconscious. And so the idea of milk, of course, being in line with that set of imagery. Okay. So this is the second dream. So I think you'll agree that regardless of how we exactly interpret it, but these dreams are actually very short, but they're very evocative. And they're calling to mind a whole range of images and ideas. Sorry, yes? A good question. So the question was this all on one night or was this in many several different nights? It doesn't actually say. So the sutra itself, I think the normal understanding is that it was all in one night. But the sutra itself doesn't mention that. So, yeah. Okay, so next one. White caterpillars with black heads crawled up to his feet and covered his knees. Now, in Sanskrit, it's a little bit different. The Sanskrit is before the Buddha was enlightened. Red creatures. Pranaka means like a little creature, like an insect or something like that, or grub. Lohitika. So little creatures could even mean leeches. Lohitika means red, but it also literally means bloody. Leeches crawling up? Makes sense, right? Maybe. Of course, sorry? Fair enough, yeah. They don't tend to swarm like that, do they? So the rest of it is exactly the same. So the red creatures, the red creepy crawlies with black heads crawled up from his feet and covered his knees. Now, normally, whenever this has been translated before, it's always translated as like worms or grubs, right? And in the explanation of it, which we've just heard a little bit before, it explains it as being this is the lay community who's going for refuge to the Buddha. So so charming, right? Yeah. So thanks so much, Buddha. Exactly, right? So when I was looking at that, actually the Pali word is kimi. And kimi is a very general word, right? And it can mean like a grub or a worm or something like that, but it can also mean a caterpillar. And so I did this one of the things I found a little bit of research on when I was doing my translations. I did a little essay, Rejoice, for you are not a worm. And if you're interested in these essays that I've done, so this is on our forum, discourse.sutacentral.net, and I did a series of essays all under the tag. Let me show the tag. There is a tag there. Or did I leave the tag out? I might have forgotten the tag on this one. Oh, my God. I think I forgot the tag. Oh, I forgot the tag on this one. That's bad. Anyway, let me see if I can just put that in quickly. No, it's going to take too long. I'll do it in the break. Anyway, so they're all under the tag EBT translation, and that gives you a series of essays. I've done about 130 or something like that, that will discuss different aspects of the translations and so on. So this is a fairly short one. So something a little bit odd in the idea that the Buddha's unconscious depicts lay followers as worms. Okay, so however, kimi is a generic term for soft-bodied worm-like creatures, and as Venerable Dhammika points out, in the Melinda, page 308, the kimi are said to devour the crops, so it must mean caterpillars, or at least include caterpillars. And it's not uncommon for caterpillars in the Indic region to have white bodies and black heads. Witness a lovely, newly hatched Malay dartlet. Right? It's cute. Yeah? And this is a sweet Caprona ransonetti, and this is an Indian caterpillar. Right? So I think it's pretty likely that this is what the Buddha was meaning rather than worms and grubs. But caterpillars are cute, but it's more than that. They turn into this. Yeah. So there's a much more meaningful reading of the simile, right? Not only is phew, you don't have to be a worm. The Buddha wasn't subconsciously thinking of you as grubs. Excellent. Right? But you come to him as already very cute caterpillars, right? You're already very cute, and then you turn into these spectacular butterflies when you practice the Dhamma. Generally speaking, yeah, I think so. Maybe. So this is the kimi. I really should have organized these better. Where did I go? Oh, here we are. All right. Yes, and in the That's right. In the Sanskrit one, the Lohitika Puranika, red creatures, something like that. Not quite sure, again, where that difference comes from. Okay, moving along. The next one. Four birds of different colors came from the four directions. They fell at his feet, turning pure white. So again, this has that idea of transformation, which kind of reinforces that thing. In the Sanskrit version, before the Buddha was enlightened, four birds, actually there's a textual mistake in the Sanskrit here, the word birds is missing. Four birds of different colors, many different colors, came from the flying from the four directions, and having fell at the Buddha's feet, they all transformed into white. So there's a few changes in the wording there, but basically it's exactly the same as the Pali. Then the fifth dream, the fifth dream in Sanskrit, before the Buddha was awakened, he walked back and forth on the top of a giant mountain of filth. This was the fifth dream that he had, or that he saw in the Sanskrit version. Okay. So this one gives more that image of like transcendence and letting things go rather than the imminent imagery we saw before. And I think it's important to bear that in mind because images are just images. Metaphors are just metaphors. It's not like the full reality. It's just like a way of painting a picture or evoking a part of the truth, right? So don't mistake the metaphor for the whole truth. The metaphor is getting at a bit of the truth. But if we look at all of these different parts, then we get a better idea. From some respects, we can see that the Buddha's awakening was like transcending everything. But in another respect, you can say that it's like just letting everything go through you. Okay. So I will now continue and just briefly look at the definition. An explanation that's given in the sutta. So then it gives you the dreams and then it gives you the explanation for the dreams. And if only interpreting dreams was always this easy, right? And you could go to the therapist and he'd say, oh, yes, you had this dream. I dreamt that I was giving a presentation and at school and I was naked. What does that mean? Ah, means you're going to get enlightened. Oh, fantastic. Okay, so... So the first one, when lying down with the Himalayas as his, with the earth as his bed, the Himalayas as his pillow, and his hands and feet in the oceans. This was fulfilled when the Buddha awakened to the perfect awakening. And in the Sanskrit version, it is almost exactly the same. But there's one little difference, which is interesting, is that it says that the Buddha realized the supreme perfect enlightenment, this is the result of that great dream. Yeah? Ayam tasya maha sapyanasa vipako. Which is interesting because that idea isn't found in the Pali at all. Right? It literally says that's the vipaka, right? It's the karmic fruit of that great dream. Which is curious. I don't quite know what it could mean there. And certainly no one's ever taught that the enlightenment was a result of dreams. But anyway, that's what the text says. So that's a little curiosity there. Somebody might have an idea of what it's getting at. I'm not quite sure about that. But the main point here being that the first one is a foretelling of his enlightenment. Now, that idea that a dream is foretelling the future is, of course, a very common one, right? And a lot of prophecy and dreams and mythology and so on, we find this idea. The idea that dreams are revealing our unconscious is a much more modern idea, right? This stems from Freud and from the 19th century. But for a long time, people looked to dreams for prophecy. So which one is true? Is dream prophecy or is it revealing your unconscious? Well, probably a bit of both. Maybe your unconscious is not quite so attached, not quite so tethered to time as your waking consciousness. maybe time itself is a product of consciousness. Maybe we create the present moment because of the way that we think about it. Yeah? But time itself is looser and slipperier. And maybe when we delve into those looser and slipperier parts of our mind, time itself is not quite what we think it might be. Yeah? There was some research done on that in modern times in the book, The Irreducible Mind. Is it Irreducible Mind? Is that right? Alex is nodding. Thanks, Alex. And they looked into this particular question, and it's a very interesting piece of research, right? Because we always think that dreams are going to be telling us, dreams are replaying some events of the past, right? So something happens in that day and then the dream will reflect that. Obviously, that happens a lot, right? But what they did is that they asked people to write down how many times the dreams reflected things that have happened in the previous 3 days, right? And how many times the dreams reflected things that happened in the subsequent 3 days, the 3 days after the dream. Right? And they found, rather to their surprise, that it was about the same number. So your dreams are reflecting that, if this is right, I'm just raising it as an idea. But perhaps there is something to this idea that time isn't as linear as we think, and that we construct time in a way to make sense of our lives. But in the unconscious, that time is operating in a slightly different way. So anyhow, the idea here is the Buddha was in some sense predicting his enlightenment. Notice, though, that he's not like saying consciously, right, that he's doing this. And it's not like ages before, right? This is just on the eve of his enlightenment, right? He's almost there. And his unconscious is telling us, you know, you're just about to cross the finish line. Right? Keep going. Don't give up now. I know you're tempted to go to Starbucks and have a cappuccino, but no, just keep meditating. Right? So, it's sharing something of the magnificence and the cosmic dimension of that awakening. Okay. Then the second one. Second great dream is the appearance of the caterpillars. And I'm just trying to find that in the... The second great dream is the crosser. And here we are, all right. In the Sanskrit version, it says that the Sanskrit's not punctuated very much, so I just got to make sure I've got the right one with the right one. Okay, so what it says here is that after the Tathagata, the realized one, had directly known this world and the next world with his own personal realization, then had set rolling forth the wheel of the Dhamma in the deer park in Meghadaya. So having known this world with its gods and its maras and its brahmas, with its ascetics and brahmins, this generation with its gods and its men, then he set rolling forth the wheel of the teaching in the deer park in Benares and the Rishi's Grove. He set forth rolling the supreme wheel of Dhamma that has 3 cycles and 12 factors and which cannot be rolled back by any ascetic or brahmin or god or mara or by anyone in the world. And that teaching is the 4 noble truths. That is to say, the noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path of practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. Having heard this teaching of the Dhamma, And furthermore, having heard this teaching of the Dhamma, the earth deities uttered this cry. Good sirs, the Blessed One in the deer park in Benares, in the Rishi's Grove, has rolled forth the supreme wheel of the Dhamma. So this is now the voice of the earth deities with the three cycles and the 12 factors, which cannot be turned back by any ascetic or Brahman or God or Brahma or Mara or by anyone in the world. That is to say, the Four Noble Truths. And that will be for the benefit and the happiness of the many folk, for the compassion out of the world, for the welfare and for the happiness of gods and humans. Now, having heard the words of the earth deities, the sky deities, and then the gods of the four great kings, the gods of the 33, the gods of Yama, the gods of Tusita, the gods who delight in creation, the gods who control the creations of others, also said the same thing. And in that moment, in that instant, that sound went up as far as the Brahma world. And then it repeats that whole saying. This is the result of that great dream. Ayam tasya mahasupinasya vipako. So you can see there's obviously quite a lot more text in there in the Sanskrit as compared to the Pali, but you can see also that the text is a very familiar one. And anybody who's read any Buddhist suttas will know that the Buddha's first sermon is the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma, which is being referred to in this by name. Right, it's quoting that sutta, the title of the sutta, and it's giving you the contents of the sutta, the three cycles, okay, and the 12 factors. And these are the basic divisions of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, as we find in Pali, and we find in no less than 17 other versions across the different Buddhist canons. I won't go into detail as to what exactly those things are, but simply to notice that those things are pretty much the same, and that passage with the gods crying out the significance of that teaching also is found in, not in all versions of that first sermon, but in many of them. And here we can see that that teaching is in fact shared in common with the Mahasanghika tradition, so it must come from quite an early time. So the Pali version in this case is much shorter and much simpler. The Buddha's teaching was well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. Okay? Three words, yeah, or just a few words. So why is there that difference? Bit hard to say. Maybe the Mahasanghika had sort of, padded it out a bit, added a bit extra to it. But as you can see, adding extra to it in this case doesn't really change the meaning of it in any significant way. So this is the kind of thing, like, you know, when I talk about suttas and comparative studies of suttas and things like that, then this is what we mean when we say that the differences between one version and the other are usually very small, and where the differences do occur, then they don't really affect the main teachings very much. And when you say it like that, then it doesn't really communicate the real kind of detail and the depth to which these are really the same text. This is why we call them parallels. But you can see when we're reading these side to side that it's actually the same sutta. It's clearly the same text. I mean, there's a few minor variations from one to the other. But in fact, very often the sentences are the same with, like, exactly the same words and phrases again and again. Okay, so the next one, the white caterpillars with black heads. This was fulfilled when many white-clothed lay people went for refuge to him for life. In the Sanskrit version, it says when the, and you remember this is the red creatures, it's a slightly interesting phrase here. It says the, now, these days, many, interesting, yeah. This is phrased from a slightly different tense. It says these days, so it must be like retold somewhat later. Anyway, it says that many people had taken the Buddha as the Adhikara. It's an interesting phrase. I think it means, I'm not exactly familiar with this word in this context, but I think it means something like declared allegiance to the Buddha Well, they did the rite, or did the declaration of taking the Buddha as the adhikara, as the overseer, or as the commander, something like that. But don't mistake my idioms. I'm just trying to. It's not a term I'm very familiar with. In the Pali, it's much more familiar. It just says that they went for refuge. Obviously, it means something similar. I'm not exactly familiar with that particular idiom, adhikara kama. They took refuge with him, or they took him as went for allegiance to the Buddha. And then when their bodies broke up after they died, then they were reborn among the gods in the heaven realms. Okay, so this is another case where the Mahavastu has added some extra details to what we find in the Pali. Because all right, yeah. Maybe, yeah, maybe. It's an indication of that physical transformation, yeah. So then the next one, the four birds of different colors, and in the Sanskrit it says there are these four castes. Aristocrats, Brahmins, merchants, and workers, and then they, having practiced a holy life with the Buddha, will realize the unshakable freedom of heart and freedom by wisdom. This is the result of that dream. Okay, so here you can tell the phrasing in the Sanskrit is a little bit different, but the basic meaning is the same, that the four castes come and their different colors will disappear and they'll become white. And those of you who, like me, are great fans of Lord of the Rings will immediately remember Gandalf the White. Right? Yeah, you had all these wizards, different colors, and then it became... Okay, never mind. I give up. Okay. Which gods? Oh, that was reborn among the gods, yeah. Oh, well, it could have been any of them. Well, yeah, it could be. I mean, we've sort of seen before in the text about the different realms of existence. So according to Buddhism, there are many different realms or dimensions of existence, and then in their different beings can be reborn, and they're referred to as devas, right? Which the closest English word would be a deity or a god. And so gods are not like, you know, all-powerful or almighty or all-knowing, but they're just virtuous beings who've been reborn in a good destiny for a period of time, that's all. And so if you live a good life, then you get reborn in a good place and you have fun for a while. And then it's nice, you know, a few million years or something like that. Yeah. And then you come back here if you're lucky. Okay, so that's the fourth great dream. And then finally the fifth great dream. He climbed up a huge mountain of filth, but remained... Oh, again, it should have been he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth, and this was fulfilled. I think this is identical in the Sanskrit. Let me just check. It's a little bit more elaborate in the Sanskrit. So this refers to... okay, right. Actually, in the Sanskrit version, it elaborates it to go through the four directions. So it's talking about in each of the four directions. It says when the Buddha's living in the east, he's living in the west, whether he's living in the north, whether he's living in the south. There, if he receives honors and fame, if he's worshipped, and he accumulates many material possessions, such as robes, arms, food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites, then he will receive them without a mind of attachment and without clinging on to them and without being smeared by them, literally being smeared by them. And so again, basically the idea is the same, but it expands it to cover those four directions. So So this is the last of those five dreams. And, you know, we have seen a rather consistent pattern that in the Mahavastu, the Sanskrit text, that it does tend to expand things as found in the Pali. So if we see that once or twice, we probably should be cautious to draw too much conclusions from it. But when you see that happening persistently, then it's usually a sign that it's been subject to a bit of later expansion. Okay, so in this particular case, you'd probably conclude that the Pali text looks like it's a bit older than the Sanskrit text, right? A little bit older, a little bit more authentic. But again, I don't want to overstate that conclusion. You know, you'd want to look more closely at it and look at different parallel texts and things to be able to put that conclusion on more firm ground. But that in itself, then that does tend to indicate that the Sanskrit text has been expanded a bit, although, as you've seen, the expansions don't really affect the meaning of the text. They just sort of draw it out in a few more details. All right, Anders. Anders is asking, is it also possible that the Pali is summarized? Yes, it's possible, and that does happen occasionally, but it's far more common that texts get expanded. And the reason for that is a basic psychological reason that Buddhists essentially are petrified of losing everything, anything of the Buddha's words, right? Yeah? If you put a bit of extra in there, pad it out a bit, then that's all right. Yeah? I mean, even like what I'm doing here. I mean, I'm reading the sutta. I'm padding it out. I'm putting extra stuff in. Yeah? I'm going to keep you entertained here for the afternoon, right? So I can't just read the sutta. I've got to do some other stuff to keep you entertained. But that's okay, and you can take it or leave it. Anything that I say, you can take it or leave it. It doesn't really matter too much. The main thing is the teachings, right? So as long as you understand the teachings, that's the most important thing. So, yes, it can happen that things will be abbreviated, but the usual tendency is that they are elaborated. But what we do with text critical studies is that typically to try to put something on a firm ground, we look for multiple independent sources of evidence. So if multiple independent sources are all pointing in the same direction, then that can lead to a conclusion. Now, I'll just give you, in this particular case, what kinds of independent evidence might we have? Well, one is that the Mahavastu is certainly overall a later text, right? That's one. Number two, the language, the Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, is on the whole linguistically more advanced and later than Pali, right? So that's two pieces of evidence. By itself, it doesn't mean all that much because you can have late text written in an early language, right? There's no exact correlation between them, but it adds up to see a pattern. And then when we see that there also it tends to expand things that are found in the earlier, that also is a sign of lateness. I would also think that this specifically the adding of the idea of vipaka as a result of there, I think that also seems to me to be a later. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it seems to me likely that it's a later addition. So on the whole, I'd say with that whole pattern, yes, it's likely the Mahavastu version is a bit later. Yeah. Yes. Sorry? It's a bit hard to say. The Mahavastu itself was compiled probably a bit later than that, probably maybe 300 to 400 years after the Buddha, something like that. But like I said, it's compiled almost or largely, well, no, I shouldn't even say largely, much of it is to compile just by collating bunches of suttas. So there's a difference between the date of the collection and the date of the materials that have been collected, right? So there's no, you know, there's no real doctrinal development, right, between this and the Pali. I mean, the introduction of Vipaka might maybe a different doctrinal development, but very small. Right? So, you know, this would have been a sutta that was maintained within the Mahasanghika community for hundreds of years before being included in Mahavastu. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. No. Occasionally. It's quite rare. Yeah, there are one or two things here and there, but not much. And certainly, like the Buddha didn't ascribe, on the whole, any particular spiritual significance to dreams, right? Unlike the Upanishads, which I'll go into a bit later. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And again, that's quite interesting why that difference is there. Yeah. Yes, there was one at the back. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Such as? Okay, I know. Yeah, on the heap of filth. No, that's actually in the Pali. I just made a mistake in my translation. His translation's correct there. Yeah, I've corrected it already, but it hasn't showed up on the site. Yeah. So I actually just checked that just before the thing, and I looked at mine. I thought, hang on, that doesn't seem right. And I saw, no, actually, Tanisha got that one right. Yeah. Right. So which one? Yep. Oh, the arms food, right? Yep. Right. So that also is in the Pali. The difference in the Sanskrit is that it talks about, it puts it into four directions, when the Buddha is staying in these four directions, which is not found in the Pali. And it also mentions, as well as just receiving the robes, alms, food, and so on, it also mentions receiving gain, honors, and fame. Yeah. So it's just a bit expanded. Yeah. Yep. Right. It was after, so he was giving the talk where he was mentioning his talking about these dreams to the monks, right? Now in Pali text it doesn't give us anything in terms of context, right? It just says this, so we can just guess. The Mahavastu, I'll just see, Mahavastu, because the Mahavastu is presenting it in the context of the Buddha's overall life story, right? So it actually does give us a bit more context. I'll just see exactly what the context is. The dreams of Suddhodana, sorry. Yeah. Which one? That's one word, yeah. Jivara pinda pata senasana gilana pachaya besa javare kanam. And this is one of Blake's greatest achievements in coding for Sutta Central, that you can see that it's almost completely broken that compound up correctly into all the different elements, which is pretty impressive. Doesn't quite get it at the end, but he's got most of them. Yeah. So in the Mahavastu, it's given in the, it says, it starts out by saying, then Suddhodana, Buddha's father, saw a certain dream and then tells his dream. And then it says that his mother also saw a dream and then tells her dream. It says that Yashodhara, the Buddha's wife, also saw a dream. So I guess this would be putting this all before the Buddha's enlightenment, that is, everyone in his family saw these dreams at the same time, right, just before the Buddha's enlightenment, which is quite interesting. So this is actually telling it at the time. If we looked in the Pali tradition at the biographies of the Buddha, then it would tell us more about the context. But see, the problem is it tells us the context when the dreams occurred, but it doesn't tell us the context when he taught them. It's an interesting question, because I'm sure that there must have been some interesting reason why he gave such an unusual teaching, right? And maybe someone asked him, oh, Buddha, do you ever dream, right? Yes, that's right, but I think what the Mahavastu is saying is that even though the Buddha was out in the forest and meditating, but still his family all had these dreams on the same night. Not that they had the same dreams, but that they all had these great dreams on the same night. And then it's recorded that. Oh, his mother, yeah, it must be referring to Mahapajapati. Yeah. Mahapajapati is often referred to as his mother. Yeah. Matuswapi Sukinam Pasiti. Because this the it's interesting what they're dreaming on the same night, right? But unfortunately, it's in the hybrid Sanskrit verse, and I'm not going to try to read that for you because it's all hard and stuff. All right. Sorry, yes. All right. Ardinava. Ardinava? Yeah. Ardinava is seeing the drawbacks. Yeah. So this is, of course, this is a common teaching in the Dhamma, that when seeing anything, especially something which is nice, then you see it from three perspectives. First of all is the advantage of it, what's actually good about it. Second one is what's bad about it, what's the drawback. And thirdly is the escape, right? Is like how do you get beyond it or become free from it? And that's like really, really handy next time you go shopping, okay? Because that's exactly what advertising does, right? It makes you only want to see the good side of it. Ah, this is really tasty. Yeah. Yeah, it looks really good or whatever. But that's fine. That's part of that reality. But when you next time you go to buy something, ask yourself, what's the drawback as well? Yeah? And what's the escape? And sometimes the escape is I'm just going to leave it on the shelf. Yeah. Because you see it more fully. Yeah. So the Buddha used these without being attached to them. Okay, so we've been talking for a while. Let's have a break, and we'll come back around, say, 5 o'clock. Is 25 minutes break okay? Does that sound good? Okay, let's do that.